Got that on? Yes, thank you. Well, I appreciate Ross stepping in last week at the last minute. I injured my back and couldn't even get in a car or get out of the car, let alone get to the class last week. But thanks to the president of our Orange County chapter, I'm back on the mend. He says within 3 weeks I should be pain-free, so I'm looking forward to that. So,
is this part of the same injury you had before?
I've injured my back 4 times, but this is the worst incident I've had. So, and I'm hoping to avoid surgery, so hopefully with the right exercises. I found I was doing the wrong exercise program, making it worse rather than better. So, what we're going to go this morning, we are in Psalm 139, the psalm that deals with human origins and the care that God shows towards every human being in the human species. But what has happened in the past week is some really amazing discoveries have been made about Jupiter and Saturn. Here's a segue. I'm going to show you some things about Jupiter and Saturn that show you the degree to which God cares for the planets in our solar system, which I think will make a nice segue to Psalm 139, how God cares for each one of us. If he cares that much for mere planets, then, well, I think you get the idea. So, yeah, if we could turn the lights down, you could actually see those planets that are up there. That's all thanks to JPL. A few of you here are from JPL, so thanks to you, we have these wonderful images of the planets in our solar system. And appropriately, we have Pluto off the list here, so we're down to just the 8 that are there. Now, a lot of people what I'm going to do is kind of give you a visual picture for what the solar system actually looks like. And, you know, the Earth is 7,913 miles in diameter. And I've always had this vision of having a planetary park where we actually kind of lay out the solar system to scale. And to really make this feasible, you'd have to scale down planet Earth to the size of 1 inch. So Earth is 1 inch in diameter. And on that scale, the Sun would be about 10 feet in diameter. If you want to get an idea of what it's like, you can squeeze 1,300,000 planet Earths inside the ball of the Sun. Jupiter is quite a bit smaller, but a lot larger than the Earth. It would actually measure 11.22 inches in diameter on this scale. And Saturn comes in at 9.41 inches in diameter. Now, on this scale, how far away do you think you would need to go from the Earth to bump into the planet Jupiter? Anybody want to hazard a guess?
A couple of miles?
A couple of miles? Actually, not quite that far.
1,000 feet.
It works out to about 3/4 of a mile. That's the minimum distance. The maximum distance is about a mile, 1.1 miles away. So yeah, if the Earth is just 1 inch, you literally got to walk a mile to get to Jupiter. And if you want to get to Saturn, it's going to be anywhere between 1.5 miles and 2 miles away that you'll have to walk. Now, how about Neptune? How far do you think you'd have to hike to get from the Earth out to Neptune?
2 miles.
2 miles? You have to go 8 miles. So that would make a nice park. I mean, in a day's hike, you could start off at the Sun, and 9 miles later, you'd be out to Neptune. So that gives you an idea of the relative distances, yes.
Hugh, why don't you set up a geocache?
Well, that's kind of an idea I've always had. It'd be fun to find a nice, pretty place where there's not too many trees, actually set up all these things, and then make a hiking trail through it all. That'd be kind of fun. And, you know, this would be just ideal, because about 9 miles is the limit for most people's hiking. And, hey, if you want to quit at Saturn, you could quit at Saturn. I mean, whatever it takes. Yeah, go ahead.
There's a town up in... I think it's near San Francisco that did this.
They actually did that, yeah.
I think City Hall is where the Sun is. And
uh-huh.
It just went out.
Right, yeah. But just to have actually little scaled models of all the planets, that'd be kind of fun.
Yeah.
Yes?
I've been doing this for a couple of years now over in Monrovia. If anybody wants to tell, we've developed a hiking trail, and at its entrance is the Sun at 50 inches, which is a circle. It has a plant growing out of it, and it's that shows the Sun energy makes plants and runs the atmosphere. But the hiking trail takes us all the way through up to a flat area where the Mars and asteroids would be to
solve the problem of space. And this is in a large bowl area where we can actually see one planet and sight from one to the other. And we talk about nature a little bit at each planet stop besides the planet. But the gaseous, the gas giants suddenly realized at the top of the hill that we can point to places, landmarks in the city, and not actually have to hike there. It does include the whole solar system.
There you go.
So if anybody would like to help on that, it's
right. Well, also notice on this scale, if you're standing at the Earth and trying to look out to Mars, you're not going to see, pardon me, out to Jupiter. You're not going to see Jupiter, even though it's almost a foot in diameter, unless you've got a pair of binoculars. Anyway, that's a segue to two articles that have been published by two Chinese-American astronomers. And we can have the lights back up. I can actually see what's on these sheets of paper. So, thank you. The first paper was published last May. And I was going to report to you what they had discovered to the class, but I read the end of the paper that this was simply part one and part two was going to be coming out. Part two got published just a few days ago. And what these two Chinese-American astronomers did is that they're trying to figure out how Jupiter and Saturn in our solar system got the characteristics that they possess. And so their model is to take a planetary system where you got a star like the Sun and a planet like Jupiter and a planet like Saturn, and then kind of do a detailed computer modeling of their birth and history. And in their first paper, they used the analog of the solar system, where they had Jupiter, which is about three times bigger than Saturn in terms of its mass, the close-in planet, and Saturn, the far-away planet. And when they ran the model, what they discovered is they got one of two things. Either Jupiter and Saturn would have a runaway migration where they would come together, or a runaway migration where they would go apart. And so what would happen is Saturn would wind up leaving the solar system, and Jupiter would be heading towards the Sun. And that actually explains why when we discover extrasolar planets, so many of them are gas giant planets that are orbiting close to the star. And what they're saying is, you know, with that kind of a situation, the smaller planet would leave the planetary system, the bigger planet would wind up becoming what astronomers call hot Jupiters. And most gas giants that we discover are actually orbiting their stars closer than Mercury orbits our star. So yeah, they really are hot Jupiters. So, now, what they did do is they played around with the model a little bit to say, how can we stop the runaway divergent migration where they kind of go farther and farther apart from one another, or the opposite, which is a runaway inward migration where they come closer and closer together. And they found there were ways to avoid that. But the only ways that avoided it caused the two planets to get trapped into what we call mean motion resonances. And the first mean motion resonance that they wind up getting trapped in was called the 2-1. Now, the 2-1 mean motion resonance is where the inner planet, which would be the bigger one, the Jupiter-sized planet, would make exactly two orbits around its star for every single orbit of the smaller gas giant, the Saturn analog. That's what's called the 1-2 resonance. And Jupiter and Saturn are relatively close to that, but not exactly on. Now, the problem with that resonance is that means that for every two orbits of Jupiter, you get Saturn and Jupiter perfectly lining up, which means their gravity now gives a strong pulse on the other planets in the solar system. And in due time, that disrupts the orbits of the smaller planets. And, if you're interested in finding a planetary system where life can possibly exist, and especially advanced life, the small planet, the rocky Earth-like planet, can't be bounced around by the big boys. So you really want to avoid those mean motion resonances. But what they discovered is the only way they could avoid the divergent separation or the convergent separation is if they wind up getting into this 2-1 resonance. Now, they played around with the model a little bit more and said, okay, now it gets stuck in the 2-1 resonance. What can we do to the model so that it gets out of that 2-1 resonance? Well, they found that there was some exotic physics that they could bring in, which would actually cause it to get trapped into the 2-1 resonance, and after a period of time, a considerable period of time, it could break free. But the moment it breaks free, it gets trapped into a 3-2 resonance. And a 3-2 resonance is where the Jupiter-type planet would make exactly 2 orbits for every 3 orbits of the more distant planet. Moreover, they discovered that if it goes from the 2-1 resonance to the 3-2 resonance, it quickly jumps out of the 3-2 resonance and permanently reverts back to the 2-1 resonance. Bottom line, they say, with a Jupiter-Saturn analog, you get a planetary system where life can't possibly exist because we can't. You either get the divergent or the convergent, or it winds up getting stuck into one of these resonances. That was paper number one. And the real goal of the research was to see if they could explain how our solar system got to have the characteristics that it did. But they said, bottom line, they concluded, we don't know how Jupiter and Saturn wound up with the lucky break that they wound up getting. But then in paper two, which got published just a few days ago, what they did is they did the opposite. They said, okay, let's have Jupiter and Saturn switch places. So you have the smaller planet interior to the more massive planet. And let's see what happens. Well, when they ran that model, they also discovered they discovered a couple of things. That if the relative distance between the two planets is large, you get a divergent migration. In other words, they become farther and farther apart. And if the distance is small, then they get closer and closer together. But as they get closer and closer together, an instability develops, which causes either the smaller the two planets or the bigger the two planets to rapidly move in towards the star and then develop what's called a high eccentricity. Now, all planets have eccentric orbits. What I mean by that is none of the planets are perfectly circular. It's Newton's laws of motion. When a planet goes around a star, it has an elliptical orbit. But what makes life feasible in our solar system is the ellipticity or the eccentricity of our planets. For every one of them except for Mercury is small. Now, Mercury is such a tiny planet and so close to the Sun, the fact that it's eccentric has no impact on the Earth. But if you were to have Venus eccentric or Jupiter eccentric, that would be a real problem. Because what that would mean is in one part of the orbit, Jupiter would be much closer to the Sun than in another part of its orbit. So you really want the orbits to be very close to circular. And that's one of the amazing characteristics of our planetary system, the fact that all the planets have close to perfectly circular orbits. For example, the Earth is about 1% eccentric, so it's only a 1% departure from a circular orbit. And actually, that works out to our benefit, because as you look at the orbit of the Earth, we are closest to the Sun in the wintertime and farthest away from the Sun in the summertime. Now, that's for the northern hemisphere. For the southern hemisphere, it's the other way around. But if you look at planet Earth, notice how much land mass you have in the northern hemisphere and how little you have in the southern hemisphere. Moreover, if you look at the southern hemisphere continents, they're all shaped like triangles. And so if you look at South America, almost all of its land mass is near the equator, and there's only a little tiny sliver that's down at, say, 40 to 50 degrees south latitude. And that's where you get the greatest impact of being close to the Sun or farthest away from the Sun. And incidentally, if you were to live in the southern tip of South America, you'd get very great differences between summer and winter. Also explains why Antarctica is so much more filled with ice than the North Pole, because it gets those extreme differences between summer and winter. And so Another reason why he can thank God for the way he designed the earth, he put most of the continental landmass above, say, 30 degrees south latitude, whereas below 30 degrees south latitude, you'd be beginning to have some serious climate problems. So the fact that we have this 1% departure from a perfect circle actually works to our benefit, at least those of us that are living north of the 30 degrees south latitude, which is about 99% of the world's population. So the continents, the way they're shaped, is no accident. By the way, I've got an article coming up on that in today's New Reason to Believe on the reasons.org website. That, by the way, is a free service. Every day you get an email from a ministry, from one of our scientists, giving us some new evidence for the supernatural design of the realm of nature for the benefit of life and the human beings. But what the second paper basically points out is that if you have Jupiter on the outside and Saturn on the inside, it will lead to an instability that explains why so many of the planets that we observe outside of our solar system are what we call eccentric hot Saturns or eccentric hot Jupiters. If the bigger one is on the outside rather than the inside, it will cause one of the planets to wind up being very close to the star with a highly eccentric orbit. And by the way, the movement from the place where it forms, incidentally, gas giant planets can only form beyond what's called the snow line. The snow line is that distance from the star where water is permanently frozen. And that's where gas giant planets form. But if you look at the extrasolar encyclopedia, just put an extrasolar encyclopedia in your search engine, and up will pop a French website, in English, by the way, what lists every single planet that's been discovered outside of our solar system. And what you'll notice is that the vast majority of them are planets like Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Jupiter that are orbiting relatively close to their stars with these very elliptical or eccentric orbits, which means that they're not possible to have another planet in the system in which life exists. I looked at the site this morning. 474 planets have now been discovered outside of our solar system, and in every single case, that planet has characteristics that would rule out the possibility of a planet in the same system with the capacity to support advanced life. I say that because this past week an announcement came out from Seth Shostak, who heads up the SETI team out of Santa Cruz, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligent Life, where he predicted within 25 years we'll make contact with an intelligent civilization. Well, the truth of the matter is we don't even have a planetary system we can see up there that could be a conceivable candidate in which a planet could exist that could harbor advanced life. For that matter, we don't even have a single star we can see in our Milky Way galaxy that has the necessary characteristics, like our star, the Sun, where a planet conceivably could orbit it in which advanced life would be possible. Your tax dollars at work. You're searching for these signals when we already know ahead of time that the star has the wrong characteristics and the planets orbiting that star have the wrong characteristics to even make it a candidate for a planet on which to have advanced life. Yes, Ross.
That 474, is that a big enough number that from a probability standpoint we could start doing some mathematical modeling and say, you know, are they doing that and saying that this really is going to be the only planet we're going to find?
Well, that's what these two papers are about. I've counted over 100 papers that are taking the statistics of these 474 extrasolar planets and trying to determine how those planets form, and then use that as a way to determine how our solar system formed and why our solar system is appearing to be unique in its capacity to support advanced life. I mean, one thing that's happened through this modeling is we recognize that what's unique about our solar system is how devoid it is of what astronomers call volatiles. Volatiles are light gases, and we are extremely poor in carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, water. For example, our solar system is about 1,000 times poorer in carbon than these other systems we're observing through our telescopes. And so the problem with these extrasolar planets is they got about 1,000 times more carbon on them than we would have. I mean, so isn't that good? We're all carbon-based life, right? But too much carbon is a real problem. With too much carbon, they're going to get thick atmospheres loaded with carbon dioxide or methane or carbon monoxide, and too much of any of those things is deadly to life. And so if you look at Earth, for example, we have 2,400 times less carbon on our planet than what you see in the rest of the universe. So we're that short of carbon, and we're also roughly that short of nitrogen. And both of those work to make advanced life possible. With respect to water, we're about 500 times poorer in water than you'd expect for planets of the same temperature of Earth. So the fact is we have continents because of the fact that Earth is so extremely water poor. We're now finding planets, by the way, that are just barely bigger than planet Earth. And we're finding them about the appropriate distance that Earth is from our star. And we're discovering that they're between 10 and 50% water. Whereas our planet is somewhere between 0.02 and 0.03% water. And if you had 10 to 50% water, you can forget about continents. That's just not going to happen. There's going to be a huge deep ocean permanently on that particular planet. So, yes.
Have they gone further in those two-part article to determine how did our system get away?
Well, astronomers have successfully, in their modeling, been able to produce the characteristics of the solar system. But they can only do it with gas giants that take on exactly the characteristics of Uranus, Neptune, Saturn, and Jupiter. And by the way, they find they got to throw in Earth and Venus as well to make it all work. With that appropriate setup, you can come up with a model that avoids these mean motion resonance traps. Now, even with that model, Jupiter and Saturn do go into a 2-1 mean motion trap. But the trap is extremely temporary, because the other thing these models have determined is it is crucial that you fine-tune the characteristics of both the Oort cloud and especially the Kuiper belt of comets. And so the way the model is successfully able to duplicate the conditions of the solar system is you make the Kuiper belt about 100 times bigger than it is today, and you place it a little bit interior to where the orbit of Saturn is right now. The Kuiper belt right now is beyond Neptune. It's between 4 and 6 billion miles away. Neptune is just a little bit shy of 4 billion miles away. But if you have the primordial Kuiper belt in between, you know, centered in between where Jupiter and Saturn are right now, you get a powerful interaction between the Kuiper belt, Jupiter, and Saturn, which causes both Jupiter and Saturn to slowly migrate outward. But Saturn migrates outward a little bit more rapidly than Jupiter does. And after about 700 million years, they wind up in this 2-1 resonance. But the 2-1 resonance has the biggest impact on disrupting the Kuiper belt. And so the Kuiper belt winds up being 99% destroyed by the 2-1 resonance. And what that does is it causes all four gas giants to migrate a little farther out, wind up with almost perfectly circular orbits. They stop migrating, and they wind up stopping in a position where there's no more mean motion resonances. There's no more mean motion resonances if you also fine-tune the inner solar system planets. So you need to have Mars, Earth, and Venus, and incidentally, they've now discovered the Moon also plays a crucial role in making sure the mean motion resonances don't wind up being re-established. That's the only way you can make the whole thing work. Now, of course, if you start to work up the probabilities of all that happening by chance, you realize that it's an astronomically remote probability too.
So that 2-1 resonance when it hit our solar system.
Right.
That was the late heavy bombardment.
That was the late heavy bombardment. And that late heavy bombardment transformed the interior of the Earth so that the Earth would wind up with a very powerful permanent dynamo that gave us a magnetic field that prevented our atmosphere from being sputtered away by the radiation of the sun, and also provided a Van Allen belt of protection that guarded us from X-ray and ultraviolet radiation coming in from the galaxy as well as the sun, and also established the plate tectonic engine and the mantle of the Earth that led to the development of the continents.
I thought the moon was mainly responsible for the magnetic
field.
The moon formation.
Okay. The moon formation event had the bigger contribution in restructuring the two cores of the Earth. We know that there's a solid inner core and there's a liquid core that surrounds the solid inner core. Although now geophysicists are beginning to favor a third model where there's three cores, where you've got a small core right at the center that's made up almost entirely of uranium, surrounded by a core made up of ferrous metals, nickel, cobalt, and iron, that is solid, and beyond that, another ferrous core made up of nickel, iron, and cobalt, plus small amounts of sulfur and oxygen. And those small amounts of sulfur and oxygen got embedded with a late heavy bombardment. So the moon-forming event wouldn't have done that. It takes a late heavy bombardment to infuse that extra oxygen and sulfur, and it takes that to actually set up that stable, long-lasting dynamo on a planet as small as the Earth. Now, you can get long-lasting dynamos on bigger planets, but the problem with a bigger planet is you're going to get stuck with an atmosphere that is too heavy and way too much water. And so, in fact, there's another article we have on our website, also with today's new reason to believe, that makes the point Earth is as big as you can get. People complain that God was stingy in the tiny planet he gave us. We now know enough about from this kind of modeling to realize Earth is the maximum size it can possibly be and still sustain advanced life. You can't make the planet any bigger and have advanced life on it. So this is the biggest it gets in this universe. But if you're complaining about how tiny our habitat space is, we do have the promise in the book of Revelation that in the new creation, we'll have a habitat space that is unimaginably large for us to enjoy for the rest of eternity. Now, we can imagine how big the universe is, right? This is going to be bigger than that. It's going to be unimaginably large. So right now, we have this tiny pale blue dot. Although what's interesting, when you look at history, people thought that the Earth was limitless until the 20th century. It's only been in the 20th century where we've had the technology to appreciate the limited size of the Earth. And if you're wealthy enough and healthy enough, you can actually explore most of our planet. But keep in mind, that's only been possible for 21st century citizens. Your grandfather could never dream of doing that. And so we're the only generation that really has a right to complain about how tiny our planet is. But I believe the Lord's returning soon, and when he does, the universe will have fulfilled its purpose, and God will guide us into a new creation where there will be a limitless habitat space where no matter how long you try to travel throughout the vastness of the new creation, you'll never be able to explore it all. Yes?
Weren't even the ancient Egyptians making estimates of the Earth's size?
The ancient Egyptians knew how big the Earth was. The early Greeks, we're talking 2,600 years ago.
Yeah.
You can read about this in my first book, The Fingerprint of God, how 2,500 years ago, just using the plane geometry theorems that you all learned in high school. You all remember those theorems? Okay. Well, the Greeks came up with those 2,600, 2,700 years ago. And using those theorems, they figured out the diameter of the Earth. They figured out how far away the moon was. They determined the Earth was a sphere, that the moon was a sphere. They determined that the sun was a sphere. They figured out how far away the sun was. And they even determined that the stars must be objects just like the sun, because they tried to measure parallax to the stars and couldn't do it with the naked eye. And maybe you don't know that term. Parallax, well, what the early Greeks tried to do, they tried to actually measure the distance to the stars. And they did it the same way they measured the distance, to the sun. They figured out, well, the Earth... By the way, they all knew that the planets went around the sun, and the sun was the center of the solar system. And so they roughly had a good idea of the size of the orbit of the Earth, and then they would look, say, make measurements in the summertime, and then make a different set of measurements in the wintertime, which means you'd have a base of a triangle 186 million miles wide. Now, the one theorem I'm sure you all remember from your high school days is that if you know the length of the base of the triangle and you can measure the angles at the base of an isosceles triangle, then you know the distance of the vertex. That's the technique astronomers use to measure distances to all the stars, galaxies, and quasars in the universe. The wonderful thing is we now have these radio telescopes that we can link together. I mean, how many have you ever heard of what's called the Very Long Baselight Array? What that is a set of 10 telescopes financed with only a few of your tax dollars. Amazingly cheap enterprise. But one of the radio telescopes is in Hawaii. A whole bunch of them across the continental United States and Alaska. Then they got one in the Virgin Islands. But what they do is they use computer and TV technology to link them all together. And so they wind up with a telescope that has the equivalent resolving power of a 6,000-mile diameter telescope. Now, you've all heard of the 100-inch telescope here in Mount Wilson. And, you know, the bigger the diameter of the mirror, the more detail you can see. Well, now we've got a telescope that's nearly 6,000 miles in diameter. And so with that, we're able to measure these angles with such precision. In fact, this just got published this past week. I should have talked to you about this. They've now got a measurement using this high school plane geometry theorem where they've been able to measure the distance to a galaxy that's 160 million light years away. Now, the advantage of being able to do that, that's in what we call the Hubble flow of the universe. That's a technical term that means you're now far enough away that the expansion of the universe velocity completely dominates the gravitational tugs and pulls of galaxies and one another. You know, in a Big Bang universe, the farther away you go, the greater the expansion velocity you observe. Well, for the first time, just this past week, they published a measurement of a galaxy. You'll see it in the September 10th issue of the Astrophysical Journal. They say it's not even September 10th yet, but they already got it published. So you can actually read about stuff in the future. But it's online. You can check it out for yourself. And now, for the first time, they got a measurement of the expansion rate of the universe using only the direct distance plane geometry theorems we all learned in high school. This is a major advance because until last week, all we had were measurements that were indirect, where we had to use standard candles. Now we got a measurement of the expansion of the universe where we don't have to use standard candles. It's all direct, assumption-free. Now, I've been sharing that with some of my young Earth creationist friends because they say in astronomy, all of your measurements are based on assumptions. I says, not this one. It's assumption-free. Just based on the geometry, and it definitely proves that we live in a universe that's about 14 billion years old. So, it also shows that we live in a universe that continuously expands. The Bible said it first. 3,000 years ago, Bible authors were claiming that we live in a universe that continuously expands. And the Bible remained the only book making that statement until the 20th century. So now we've got an assumption-free proof that we live in a universe exactly as the Bible describes. That's off the topic. I didn't mean to go there, but anyway.
Talk about parallax.
Parallax. Yeah, okay. Okay, what parallax is where you look at, say, a star in the wintertime and a star in the summertime. And you've got the 186 million base of the triangle, right? But you're going to get a different angle in the summer than you will in the winter. And so astronomers measure those angles, and that tells them how far away the star is. Now, the ancient Greeks tried to do that, but they discovered they got the identical angle in the winter that they got in the summer, which told them that the stars must be extremely far away, much more distant than the planets in our solar system. And if they're that far away, they said they must be objects just like the sun. So, these Greeks were not stupid. 2,700 years ago, they figured out that all those stars were bodies just like the sun, and shining out light as bright as the sun is. They figured out the planets went around the sun. They had worked out the approximate sizes of all the bodies in the solar system, and they knew the diameter of the Earth to within 1% precision. So, yes.
What group in history is responsible for ignoring all that and casting us into the dark?
Well, the one thing, I mean, the Greek mathematicians had launched the discipline of geometry. And, they loved the fact that geometry was so exact and assumption-free. But the Greeks did not have algebra. And because they lacked algebra, they did not have the mathematical tools to be able to accurately predict where the planets would be at different times in the future. And, there was a big astrology industry in ancient times that was predicated on knowing precisely the positions of the planets in the future. And then the astronomers were interested in trying to predict when conjunctions would take place, when planets would come close together, for example. And they couldn't do that with the limited mathematics they had unless they assume that the Earth was the center of the solar system and where everything was moving on perfectly circular orbits. And so they came up with this exotic mathematical system, which is basically circles upon circles upon circles. Why? Because there they could use the mathematics of plane geometry to calculate precisely the future positions of the planets in the sky. Now, people put a lot of blame on Ptolemy in Egypt for coming up with this system. He was familiar with the Greek astronomy. He knew that this was a bad model for the reality of the solar system. But he says it does give us the mathematically accurate answers we're looking for, given the limitations of our mathematics. And what happened is, in the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages, people kind of locked onto that mathematical tool as if it described reality. The truth is, the Greeks and the Egyptians living in the times of the Romans and the pre-Roman era knew that that was not the case. But things happen. And what happened, by the way, to break that was the discovery of what Copernicus did. Is he went to the Italian libraries and he read the original manuscripts of these Greek astronomers and basically rediscovered everything. I mean, Copernicus didn't discover anything. He just went to a library and read what was going on 2,000 years before his time, and then basically copied the Greek astronomical concepts and published it. And that led to, let's see, the reason why it stuck after Copernicus, now we had algebra. And that algebra quickly gave way to calculus. Now, with calculus, we could actually calculate the positions of the planets so precisely. We can predict, for example, where the planets in our solar system will be 250 million years out into the future with great precision. For that reason, JPL has been able to send spacecraft to these planets and get there because of the fact that calculus gives us such great precision there. So mathematics is important. So all of you who've got parents with kids in school that hate math, just say stick with it. And by the way, math gets really exciting and fun by the time you become a sophomore at university. I hated math until I was a sophomore at the university. It was just so boring and dull, but the fun stuff comes. If you wait long enough, it gets to be really fun.
For a perverted mind.
Well,
demented.
Well, for example, I would argue that there's aspects of philosophy and logic that you will not really appreciate until you study differential calculus and complex variables. That's where you really begin to appreciate logic. And so, for example, in the 19th century, that was required of every university student in Britain. No longer do they do, but the reason they required it is because how it helped them in all the other disciplines that they were studying. So, and I discovered that when I became a sophomore at the University of British Columbia. It's really fun.
What basis did the Mayans use
Sun Center?
They didn't even get that far. So.
Because they have some incredible predictions of the movement.
Well, that's another topic. So, yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, going back a few steps where we finally have proof of the expanding of the universe. How many times did they do that measurement before they got it predicted, before they said this is true? You know, they aimed at that galaxy. How many times did they measure it? I'm just curious.
Well, it was done for the first time in 1929. And it was done literally just a few miles from this building. Edwin Hubble was the one who measured the velocities of galaxies. But he was not measuring the velocities of galaxies in the Hubble flow. In other words, he was not able, with that 100-inch telescope, to measure the velocities of galaxies that are far enough away where the velocity due to the expansion of the universe dominated the velocities that result from the gravitational interactions of planets with one another. So the number he came up with is that the universe was expanding so rapidly that it showed that the cosmic creation event was only 2 billion years ago. He was off by nearly a factor of 10 times.
My question was, you said that they just recently published proof, no assumption proof.
Yeah, the first assumption-free proof of this was literally published just this past week.
And how many test points was that one done? Was it just one? I mean, they had to do more than one to see how far is that galaxy moving in this amount of time.
Well, okay, in order to get this very precise measurement with this array of 10 telescopes stretched across nearly 6,000 miles, they needed a powerful point source in the galaxy. And the only one that was sufficiently powerful and sufficiently pointy is what we call a water maser. And so what this team was doing was looking for strong water masers in distant galaxies. Now, the first such galaxy outside of our local group that they found one in is something called NGC 4258. Others of you might know it as M106. It's 23 million light years away. And that got published about 5 years ago. But it was not in the Hubble flow. Nevertheless, it was far enough away where they got a rough estimate as to the expansion rate of the universe. Basically, it was about 10% accurate. But the goal all along of that team was to actually find these strong water masers and galaxies that are really way out there. And the one that they found it literally a little less than a year ago. They discovered this water maser. So far, it's only one galaxy in the Hubble flow. But the research team is looking for other galaxies in the Hubble flow that likewise have these strong water masers. Now, they're also using it as an advertisement for your tax dollars. They're saying if we can get a more powerful array of these radio telescopes, we won't be dependent on powerful water masers, which are relatively rare. And we can actually use the, because they did find other masers, but they weren't strong enough. But with a more powerful array, they could use those weaker water masers. So far, it's just one object. But all you need is one object. If it's in the Hubble flow, that's enough. So,
a maser?
Well, I think you all know what a laser is. A maser is the same thing as a laser, except it's a microwave radiation. So, instead of being optical light, it's a radio light that you're seeing. But it's the same principle. Where you got this very pointy, bright beam of radio light. And where you got a bright, pointy beam, you can actually use this array to get very accurate angles. And so, but yeah, water masers are not that common, and so that's kind of what's holding this whole thing up. But, as I say, it's amazing. We now have a completely assumption-free measurement of the age of the universe and the fact that it's been continuously expanding. In the back.
How did it change the age of the universe?
How did it affect the age of the universe? Not by much. I mean, this particular measurement puts the age of the universe at 13.8 billion years, whereas the indirect methods, the best indirect methods we have, put it at 13.72 billion years. So it's very close to the indirect methods. And that's what was so comforting to the astronomers doing this research, They had an assumption-free method, which basically proved that the indirect methods we've been depending upon for the past 60 years are really very good, because the answer is virtually the same. So, and actually, the indirect methods still rank as more accurate because of the fact we've just had the one galaxy and only 2 years' worth of measurements means that the measurement is not as accurate as the indirect methods, but within 5 years, it'll be far more accurate.
How many measurements did they do in those 2 years?
Well, they did about, it was more than a dozen measurements. I got the paper in my briefcase if you want the exact number.
No, but that was really my question.
Yeah.
Was how many measurements are they basing that speed on? About 12.
Yeah, well, the more angle measurements you make, the more accurate the result. And so, yeah, they did it over almost 2 years, but they closed off their paper saying, you know, if you give us 5 years' worth of measurements, we're going to have a really accurate measure. And when we do, we'll publish it. So wait 3 more years, and they'll come up with an even better measurement. Yes?
Is this a fatal blow to young Earth creationism once this gets out, or will they figure out a way to...
No, it really is a fatal blow, because they've always been saying there's assumptions, and we can't trust the assumptions. Excuse me. This new measurement isn't based on any assumptions at all, but it also shows that the assumptions we've made in the past are all relevant, they're all reliable assumptions, because we got the same answer.
How do you think they'll respond to this?
Well, so far they don't know about it. But, well, in terms of how they will respond to it, I think they'll respond to it the way they've always responded to it, is that we can't trust anything in the record of nature. We can only trust what's in the Bible, but it's the Bible itself that tells us the record of nature is trustworthy and reliable. So, bottom line is, I found that most young Earth creationist leaders are what I would call believing in one book revelation only. You know, the Belgic Confession says God gave us two books, and we're to read and study both books. Which reminds me, we're running out of time here in the class. It's time to go to the second book of Revelation that we've been given here. Now, what's fun about being alive in the 21st century is this book of nature is expanding at an incredible rate. I mean, literally in my field of astronomy, we double our knowledge base every 4.5 years. So that's how rapidly knowledge is expanding. So naturally we're living in a day and an age when we're coming up with discoveries. That's why it reasons to believe we can publish an article literally every day, giving you new evidence for the Christian faith. And if we had the scientific team, we could publish 10 a day. I mean, that's kind of what concerns me. As I read the scientific literature, it's like, what are these things, out of all these hundreds of discoveries, which one am I going to report on? You actually have to pick and choose. So some of the best ones we don't get to ever write about. Anyway, back to Psalm 139. Okay, just to kind of pick up where we left off, in Psalm 139, we see David declaring that God is in control of the events in his life. He controlled the birth date, the birthplace, and he was in control. Here's David still alive, declaring that God had already written on his calendar, his heavenly calendar, the exact date and place that David would end his life. And therefore, David said, I have no concern about coming death. That's under God's control. It was under God's control before he created the universe. The precise day and time that I would be born, and the precise day and time that I would leave this life. And so what we've been doing is going through 1 Samuel and noting that just in a 13-year period, God supernaturally intervened to save the life of David and his 30 mighty men, and did that 20 times over, just for King David alone. So just in a 13-year span. And of course, after he became king, again, we see that that continues. But the other thing we notice is, it's not just with respect to life, it's also with respect to death. David saw God supernaturally intervening to bring death at just the right time and just the right place to fulfill his purpose. He got to see the death of his enemies. He got to see the death of Saul and Jonathan before he took the throne. Both of them were taken out of the picture. If that was not the case, David would have never been able to get control of the throne. And likewise, God had ordained that it be Solomon that would succeed David, but that required the removal of four sons of David before Solomon was able to take that position. And so the point I was making as we're going through this, how many of you here will admit to being past the age of 40? Okay? A few of you will admit to that. Okay. In fact, I would argue if you're past the age of 20, you should be able to recall at least one incident in your life where you can say, that should have been my death. Or you can actually document a point where God brought death to someone that shouldn't have died. So, kind of what I'm doing, what I want to go with this is, let's encourage all of us here in the class to relate to one another those stories. Because here's the segue. If God is so concerned about Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune to make sure they have these exacting conditions so advanced life is possible, surely He must be far more concerned about the events that take place in your life. And really, it's a miracle that any of us get out of our teenage years, if we're really honest, right? I mean, you kind of grow up young thinking you're indestructible. I keep telling my sons, look, you're not indestructible. So, Dad, why do I need health insurance? Well, you're not indestructible. So, and when you get older, you realize that, and you recognize how many times God has supernaturally intervened to preserve your life, or likewise how He's intervened to bring about death where death shouldn't have happened. Okay, I shared with you last time we got together about this. I can actually document at least 8 instances in my life where I shouldn't have survived and I did. I can also document at least 2 incidences in my life where friends of mine died when they shouldn't have died. And in all cases, I can see a supernatural reason for why God brought life or preserved life and why He brought death in that particular situation. So, let me... what might be fun, I gave you a story last time about how my life was preserved. One that I didn't give you, and then I'm going to give you one about death. This all happened in the first year I arrived here in the United States. I came to the United States at age 27 after getting my PhD at the University of Toronto. And I arrived at Caltech in early January. And I'd written a letter, you know, telling them when I was going to come and all that. And they said, well, you know, we have a room for you at the Anthonaeum. And I said, well, this is nice. That'll give you some time to look for a place when I get here. But when I showed up, and unfortunately I showed up after 6 p.m., and they said, well, we had all these visiting stellar physicists come in, and they basically took up all the places that they had promised to these new postdocs. And I said, well, you know, it's 6 p.m., where? And they said, oh, don't worry about it. You can stay in the balcony. Well, it was outside. I was not prepared. So I spent 3 nights out there in the balcony. Second night I went out to a grocery chain called Lucky's. Any of you remember Lucky's? Okay. Well, I actually sold blankets. I went over there and bought a blanket and did a little bit better the second night. Then began to look for a place to live. Well, at that time, it was really difficult to find a place to live. But I did finally find a place. I won't tell you where it is, but it was an apartment complex. And everybody there was black except for me. But the price was right, and besides, it was available. Nothing else was available. So I moved in and I made friends with some of the people there. And it was close to Caltech. I could ride my bike. It seemed quite a good situation. What I did not know is that it was a drug dealer haven. You know, I saw marijuana in the place and saw a little bit of cocaine, but I was from Canada, and at that time in Canada, it was just past the Vietnam era. The Canadians had a law where if you had a small amount, they didn't bother to prosecute. I did not realize that that law was not in effect here in the United States. So I was seeing these drugs running around and thinking nothing of it, because that's the way it was in Toronto. It wasn't illegal at all. But I kept seeing this helicopter come over the place. I did not know it was a police helicopter, and I was in the pool one night, and it came down really low, and they were waving, so I waved back. Big mistake. Within about 3 seconds, these four guys hauled me physically out of the pool, dragged me into the second-story apartment, and then they began discussing amongst one of them what they were going to do with me. They were convinced I was a narcotics agent. And they said, you know, and so they were going to kill me. They were literally talking about doing me in. And I said, you know, this isn't good. So I tried to persuade them that I was an astronomer at Caltech. And they said, oh, yeah, sure. They wouldn't believe me. I tried to talk astronomy, and that didn't go anywhere. So, anyway, that was the time they were putting the 210 freeway in. So their plan was to take me out to the dugout for the freeway. And, you know, do me in and then kind of bury me and walk away. So I started praying, as you can imagine. And they began to argue with one another. And one of them was high on cocaine. And he was actually getting physical with some of the guys. And the apartment began to fill up. Soon there was about 15 of them in there. And they're all arguing about the best method to do me in. So then finally, the noise just became deafening, and this guy walked in, and he was about 6'8" and 300 pounds. And I found out he was kind of the enforcer for the drug gang that was there. And so he said, what's all this noise about? And they said, well, you know, this guy's a narc. And I kept saying, that's not true. I'm from Canada, and I threw out a few Canadianisms thinking that might go, but of course they didn't know about that. And I was giving them details about the city of Toronto. They said, we don't care if you lived in Toronto, we care what's going on now. But the guy who was 6'8" said, you know what, I want to talk to this guy, just the two of us. And so we started talking, and he came back and said, you know, there's a small possibility he's not an narc. And if we do this, it's going to get us into a heap of trouble. And so he said, I want you out of here tonight. So I moved out that night. So, and I went back to Caltech and said, do you guys know where? Because they recommended this place to me. So is this what you do to all the postdocs? So, anyway.
Welcome
to California. I was completely naive. I thought this was just like Canada, you know, that because in Canada they don't have what you would call ghettos. And I was in this part of Pasadena. I later found out a few years later from the Pasadena Police Department, there was a neighborhood, and this place is right in the middle of that neighborhood, that's responsible for 95% of the crimes committed in Pasadena. And he says, yeah, we lose a lot of people there. So they said, you were very fortunate that you survived that incident. And he says, you know, waving at that helicopter, big mistake. So, last time I ever waved at a helicopter. But a few months later, here I'm at Caltech, and again, that was a time where there was a real shortage of space. Here we were, you know, professors on the faculty at Caltech in the astronomy department. We had to share offices. There were so many of us that they took each office and split it into two. So I had the front part of the office. Another postdoc had the back part of the office. He'd been there for a whole year. That's why he got the back part. The back part's kind of the preferred spot. But he found out that I was a Christian. Didn't take him very long. I think it happened on the first day. And he was a Buddhist. But I later found out he was trying all kinds of Hindu and Buddhist different religions. Anyway, he would come in through my office every day and we would talk. And but then he would take what I'd share with him and go down to the coffee room. I didn't have coffee. I mean, I was kind of busy doing my research. But my office was right above where the astronomers would have coffee. And he would go down there every day and ridicule what I'd shared with him that morning. And this went on month after month after month. But I figured, I'm going to keep talking to this guy. And then there came a day when he went down to the coffee room and said, I cannot ridicule what Hugh Ross shared with me about the Bible and Christianity today. And so the reason why I can't is last night I prayed to give my life to Jesus Christ. So, and basically what he shared with me, because what we were debating every day, he was saying, you know what? I know what Christianity offers, but the price is too high. I'm searching for a spiritual bargain. So he tried Zen Buddhism, and he tried everything. But there was a day he walked into my office and said, you know, I've tried it all, and yeah, the price is cheaper, but the product is lousy. And then the very next day he gave his life to Christ. So, but the thing I noticed was, once he announced that to all the people having coffee, you could hear them slurp their coffee quietly for the next hour. Not a single word was spoken after he made that announcement. But what happened after that is astronomers would actually call me into their office and have me close the door. They would talk about things. None of those opportunities happened until Ian Lockhart gave his life to Christ and made that announcement in front of it. So it really began to open up doors. Just a few months later, Ian Lockhart had a sudden heart attack and died at age 32. And he was gone. But one of the things that we've been talking about is, you know, God's on a mission to bring it to him in the years that he's allotted to you. And what really struck all those astronomers, because they'd heard that story, because that's one of the things he ridiculed, was the fact that, and they realized, you know what, this guy came to Christ literally just days before he was going to be removed from this earth. And, you know, God got to him in the nick of time. And then it's like, you know, what about the rest of you? So, and Dave Rogstad, who's also on our board, was another Christian astronomer there with me. It gave us incredible opportunities to witness. What we all realize is, if it wasn't for his death, those doors wouldn't have been opened. And just like you see in the Bible, if it wasn't for, you know, Philip, or pardon me, Stephen, being stoned to death as a young man at the peak of his spiritual career, we wouldn't have 13 books in the Bible. It was the death of the young man Stephen that led to the conversion of Saul and led to his writing these amazing books we have here in the Bible. And sometimes it takes death to bring new life to people that otherwise would not receive it. I got a bunch of stories like that of people who died, but died in such a way that a baton was passed on to other people, and how God used that death to bring new life. Anyway, we got a few minutes left. I want a story for anybody here who's past the age of, say, 30, okay? And by the way, if you're 10 years of age and you got a story, that's okay too. But I know if you're past the age of 30, you've got a story. You just need to think about it. And that's one of the things I've really appreciated about looking at the way God intervenes in the record of nature. It brings to mind the way he's intervened in my own life. And if I could just give you a bit of encouragement, look at the Torah, the book of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and all the amazing miracles that God performed for the children of Israel, but how quickly they forgot the miracles. It's really important we look back on our life and realize the touch points where God supernaturally intervened, because that will help you when you begin to wonder, is God really there? All of us have those moments in our life where we feel threatened and we say, is God really there? Well, if he was there 15 times back in your past life, he's got to be here right now. Okay, I saw a hand. Are we going to give a story? Yeah.
No, I was just wondering if you had any more personal
stories. Oh, I got a ton of stories. But you know what? I'm going to give you a different one every Sunday, because what I want to do is stimulate the stories from you. Because that's what happened to me the last time I shared a story. You know, that one that happened to me when I was hiking in the Canadian mountains. People came up to after and said, you know what, that made me think of an incident in my own life. That's why I'm telling it. But you know, I don't want the stories to be all from me. I'd rather they come from you. I want each of you to look back in your life and say, that was a point where God intervened. Yes?
I have one. I have not yet figured out the significance of that as far as God's plan. But very clear to me, it was 2 years ago, I was on an off-road motorcycle ride off in the Mojave Desert. It was an organized ride, and I had gotten well behind all of the rest of the riders and the information, all checked, sweep through and everything else. And I was going up a very rocky valley and up on top of a little ridge, well after dark, and the side of my motorcycle hit a rock and threw me off the motorcycle down about 12 feet down into a boulder field, and I landed flat on my back. Vile rights, I should have been seriously injured, maimed, nobody to follow me at all. And I may have died, I may have survived, I don't know about that. But miraculously, and it has to be miraculous, I was not injured at all.
Wow.
I was not able to get myself out of there, but about an hour later, two people in a four-wheel drive vehicle came up this same canyon. They had no intention of having come up that canyon, but just on a lark or by something around, they said, well, let's try going up that canyon to get out of here. And so they were able to help me get my motorcycle righted, myself out of that gulch, and I was able to ride out of there from that. Obviously, to me, a supernatural intervention that's, in a life-threatening situation like that.
That's a double one, because it's supernatural in the way you survived the event, but it's also supernatural in that he sent rescuers.
Right.
They were not intending to go there, but God got them there at the right time in the right place. Good story. Yes?
I have about 13 years ago, I had given my blood sacrifice.
Yeah. Tell you what, let's get you up here.
Thank you. For all of us who get this on MP3,
yes,
hear the story.
Yeah, let's do that. It's actually, these stories are too good not to...
About 13 years ago, I had given my life back to...
I don't think we got that on. Let's...
The switch up is...
Is there a switch there?
Yeah.
There we go.
Hi. I told someone recently, probably when I die and end up in heaven, it's because I had an accident. So I seem to be accident prone or where things happen, but 13 years ago when I gave my life back to Christ, I was at home and I was sick. And so at work, we have these herbs. And so they're stuck together and they look like they're in a bullet. So I was too lazy to break them apart, and so I swallowed the whole thing. So I was home alone and I was ironing, and I think, oh my gosh, what am I going to do now? And so I thought, okay, and I started praying. I said, God, help me. I don't know what to do because it was stuck right here. And so I said, do I go to ER? I was just thinking. I said, oh my gosh, I come and someone's going to find me dead and this place is a mess. Anyway. And then what I said was, I just kept praying. I said, what do I do? So what I did is I did something. I kept drinking water. Nothing was happening. So I did something stupid and I tried to cough it up. And so then got lodged right here. And I said, oh, no. And so I felt like I couldn't breathe. My face was turning red. And I said, oh, I guess I'm going to die. But I didn't think about God at that point. I was thinking about him before. So I tell people, you never know when you're going to die. And so I just remember running to where the bathroom is. I don't know if I was subconsciously looking for something to do a Heimlich. And so it just popped out by itself. Just by itself, and I knew God saved me. And I couldn't sleep all night because I knew I just almost died, and I knew God saved me. Well, I had two friends that were picking me up to go to church, and they were bringing me back to church. And I told them the story. So I went to church, and after the end of the sermon, it was maybe a group this big, and I told them when we were driving, oh my God, I almost died last night. God saved me, I know. And so at the end of the sermon, the pastor, he prayed. And at the end of the prayer, he says, you know, God is telling me something, that somebody almost died, and yes, he wants you to know, yes, it was him that saved you. And so I ended up telling my story at that point.
Good. All right. Well, we are at a time. Saturn and Jupiter wound up absorbing more time than I thought, and as well as the expansion of the universe. All good stuff. Think about God intervening in your life. What I'd like to do next week is for all of us to come prepared with some testimonies just like the two you've heard. And I'm going to keep quiet as long as you guys got something to share. I'd like to get at least a dozen of these stories. And yeah, let's do it in front of the microphone. And if you want to be interviewed, I'm sure we can set up Ross here to do an interview if that will help you. Whatever it takes to get some of these stories out. So we'll do that next week. And then, well, I want to do a segue into a special message that we prepared on the supernatural origin of the human species. So with that, let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the way that you reveal yourself through the words of the Bible and through the record of nature, and Lord, also through the way you intervene in our own lives. Each one of us, Lord, is a walking testimony of your love and care for each one of us and for the people around us. Whether it be through life or death, you reveal your hand of life and truth and love. So, Father, I pray between now and next week, you'd bring to mind events that have taken place in our past life that were not accidents, that were not random, but it was your supernatural intervention to bring about all things together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Thank you.
I was in a car accident about 8.5 years ago.